Hi, welcome to Cloud Cover. My name is Ryan Dunn.
And I'm Steve Marks.
This week on the show, we are going to be talking about how to run, actually combine roles is really the idea again. So is
there a couple things, but that's one of them. Yeah,
how to combine roles,
also roles together.
Also how to use the scratch disk.
Yep.
So get into the kind of the nuances of how our storage system works and how you can put that together in your application. We'll cover the news as always and wrap up with a tip of the week on how to maintain availability in your services.
Yep.
So with that, let's kick it with the news.
Well, the most important news, of course, is that we're standing up again.
Yes.
We tried sitting down last week. Everybody pretty much hated it, including us.
Yeah.
So I don't think we're going to do it anymore.
Yeah.
We'll leave that for those.
We looked too relaxed was the problem.
People
were like, you guys look bored.
Right. Which we are most of the time. We're fairly bored with the stuff we're saying.
There were some other adjectives, but I can't explain.
Okay, anyway, so we're standing up, and welcome to the all-new Channel 9.
Yeah.
You are watching this on, unless you're watching one of the pirated, the bootleg copies.
Yeah, the BitTorrent version.
There are people there. We see you with little handheld cameras that sell those separately. But if you're watching this on Channel 9, you're watching it on a whole new code base of Channel 9 that is running on Windows Azure.
That's correct.
It's also using SQL Azure, it's using Windows Azure Table Storage, it's using Memcache. I don't know, there's this whole post here that has the other stuff that's in here. But those are sort of the infrastructure pieces.
It should say CDN, really.
It should really say CDN, yeah. So it is using the same CDN as the rest of the Windows Azure stuff.
Yep.
So pretty cool. I think that's nice actually using that.
In addition to this post, by the way, there are a number of interviews. I know Charles. He actually did an interview with Mike Sampson, Sampy, as they call him.
Sampy. Brother of another Sampy.
Yeah.
Who is on the Windows Azure team.
I don't know which one's
Mini
Sampy.
That's what it is, though. That's why Channel 9 is now on Windows Azure, because
it's the brother-brother connection.
Something like that.
So they did an interview, and he goes into a lot more technical detail on actually how it was implemented.
Yep.
It's kind of neat. But it's a good hour-long, time.
And you know what that means? Somewhere down here in the footer or something, it should probably say that this site is powered by Windows Azure. Wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah, it would be cool.
Guess what?
Well,
our second piece of news. That was like easily the best transition we've ever had on the show
anything. It was like we set it up or something.
The next piece of news we have is this Powered by Windows Azure logo program.
Yep. And it's strictly for websites, not your car. I would like one. It would be awesome to have the bumper sticker powered by Windows Azure. However, that is false.
I bet our marketing guys would get you a bumper sticker. If you were willing to drive around with that,
yeah,
I bet you could get one. No, this is for websites that you put up, and basically you get a little logo and you get to put it on here. How do you get the logo, you might ask?
I don't know.
Apparently you email pbwa@microsoft.com. There are some requirements. So if you click through this stuff, you can see...
you can't be lewd.
You can see what the actual logo looks like. That's what it looks like.
I believe you can't have any libel, pornography, or be lewd. I think those are the big requirements.
There's something like that. No depiction of Ryan Dunn.
Correct. You cannot blemish our
name. Can't be breaking the law.
And you actually have to be running Windows
work.
Azure.
Yeah, yep.
You have to have
a valid Windows Azure IP address.
You actually have to be running Windows Azure. There's no faking it.
So you can't just put this...
No faking it.
So this is cool. So if you click through there, you can see exactly what you have to do, and there's a link again to basically send this email, which is how you kick off the process and say, here's my website.
Or you can right-click, save this logo, and just put it on there.
No, you can't, because I don't know how well it comes across in the screen capture, but there's actually a watermark behind there.
No one's going to look that close. Go ahead, folks.
All right, go ahead and do that. Please don't. You'll get us fired. So if you want to get us fired, go ahead. Next up is another blog post on the Windows Azure blog about compute hours notifications.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the idea here is that if you've got one of these, like, you're on some plan that contains a certain number of compute hours.
Right.
When you've gone through 75% of them, you'll get an email that says, hey, you're getting kind of close. When you hit 100%, you'll get another email saying, hey, you're now paying the sort of consumption rate for these hours. If you hit 125%, you'll get another one. After that, I guess we figure... you know what you're doing. You're doing it on purpose. We don't send you an email every day that says, hey, you keep using more resources. So presumably that means you're a happy customer.
Or you forgot and left something on. One of the two.
Yeah, it's one of the two. But hopefully by the time you had 100%, yep, you realize that.
Where this really matters more, right, is for the folks who bought the hours in buckets.
Yeah. So like MSDN subscription is one, one of these ones where you've got some number of hours. Your intention is just to use those. This helps you catch if there's some sort of mistake, if you left something around you didn't realize, or you have something scaled past.
If on day two of the month you get a 75%, you should probably take action. That's what we're going with that.
So that's cool. So that's basically turning on now. This is the details of what goes on there. Next up, we could have done this like whole section of news, like all posts from the Windows Azure blog, because there's a Windows Azure blog post that mentions this too.
This is the Windows Azure Companion, though. It's actually a stuffed teddy bear. You get to sleep with it at night. It's a companion. Yep. Keeps you warm and cuddly.
It says nice things about high availability.
It brings the warm and fuzzy feeling of Windows Azure into your home.
Yep.
That's the
Windows Azure Companion. All right, so moving on to the next piece of news. So you want to know what it actually is? Should we tell them what it actually is?
It's kind of like WebPI.
For PHP apps.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's basically a package that you go deploy to Windows Azure, and it's got nothing in it. There's some sort of graphic here. So basically, right, you just grab this package, you upload it to Windows Azure. It does nothing.
It's a fancy bootstrapper.
Yeah, so it's got sort of nothing in there except some code that knows how to go read an Atom feed of applications and let you pick which ones you want, and then it downloads them and runs them, and
now you've got
them all running.
It installs PHP, I know, and installs like the PHP extensions, like caching extensions or something like that. It'll do pair.
Yep.
It'll do a couple other things. I know you can install WordPress from it.
Drupal.
And Joomla and some other stuff, I think.
Some other stuff. So it's a way to pretty much just let all that happen after you deploy. So you deploy this package that knows how to get everything going. And then there's some UI, and you sort of click through and decide which apps you want to install.
Exactly.
It gets them going. You decide sort of what path you want them installed under. It's kind of cool. And then if I'm remembering correctly, it's using Windows Azure Drives as sort of the back end for this, right?
Absolutely.
So you get this running, you install. It's not that it's just then when something happens, you lose it all. It mounts
the drive, installs the app into the drive, does all the configuration, then uploads the drive, and then all that kind of stuff. Or actually, you can download the drive, I guess.
It's pretty cool. So it's kind of neat. A teddy bear would have been kind of cool, too. I got to admit, that's a good idea.
They should have had it at least as a logo on there.
Yeah.
Cute little teddy bear.
If you draw them on, maybe they'll put it there.
Yeah.
Okay, so that came out. A couple other PHP things came out sort of at the same time. If you go look on the Windows Azure blog, there's some other...
Updates to the tooling.
Like the storage SDK, to some of the command line tools.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. So those ones are sort of more minor, kind of, incremental things. This is a brand new thing that's been built. Next up in the news, ASP.NET's broken. Don't know if you guys heard, but there's a fairly serious security vulnerability that was just recently disclosed in ASP.NET that has to do with this really kind of cool attack around...
I don't know if I can describe it as that, but...
It is cool, though. Okay, geekily, it's cool.
Depending on who you are.
Depending on which side of the attack you're on. No, but it's sort of... cryptographically interesting, sort of the way that the information is leaked and sort of lets someone gradually build up sort of the key to your application, which means they've got that encryption key. They can now mess with cookies. This sort of combined with another kind of vulnerability means that they can potentially download any file, the scary one being web.config from your app. Yeah. So this is a serious... I'm saying all this because people should really pay attention to this. There's a blog post up on Scott Guthrie's blog. By the time this airs on Friday, there may be more information. There may be a patch already. There may be some different
things. And there's probably another CDN.
So go look at the current... And there's probably a couple new CDN nodes. So go look at the current information then. Scott Guthrie's blog is probably the best place to follow this stuff, I think.
But there's a workaround. We should mention there is a workaround.
Yes. And so you should go follow that. There is a workaround, and it's basically just turning on custom errors in the right way. Yeah. I don't want to... Don't just take what I just said and go do it and think
you're safe. There's custom errors and there's a random sleep element to it.
Go read exactly what you should do to make sure that this sort of information leak and the cryptography isn't there. But there is a workaround that you can just do. I mean, it's not, and you do it the exact same way in Windows Azure as you would for any other ASP.NET application, because it basically just involves making changes in web.config to the settings for your app.
I actually do this already. So my blog is hosted on a third-party ISP.
I think my blog is vulnerable right now.
Yeah, and
I should probably fix that.
Yeah, but I actually my blog's hosted on a third-party ISP. And I went out, and it took, like, literally 5 minutes. You cut, paste, drop a file in the directory, you change something in the web config, you're done.
And that's about it.
That's it.
Yep.
So fix it.
It's good. So don't wait. I mean, just go apply the workaround now. A lot of you may already be doing it, depending on how you handle customer errors, but look at all the details of what
needs
to be the case.
And also, don't assume because you're not running ASP.NET that you're not vulnerable. If you're running WCF services and IIS, if you're running basically anything that uses the ASP.NET pipeline, even if it's not directly web pages, you're probably still vulnerable. Go check it out. Make sure you apply this workaround.
So go read carefully.
Yeah.
Do what it says. Okay, and this last one is part two, which we speculated when we saw a blog post that ended with part one.
There was at least 11.
That there'd be at least one more part.
Okay.
Where part two, and you know what he says here, this is the second in a series of posts I'm writing, so I'm confidently going to say there's going to be at least one more part.
I think there's going to be 11. I'm calling 11.
All right. The line is at 11. If you'd like to place a bet, call Ryan.
Yeah. But this is cool. It's a continuation. We talked about it last week. He's measuring the throughput of our blob storage using 500 megabyte files. And, you know, you can read the post, go into a lot more detail, but the short here is...
And there's a graph.
If you're downloading a file, go ahead, download it serially. Don't try to break it up into bit ranges or range bytes and download those in parallel. There's no benefit. It's actually just as fast or faster to just, say, download the file in one go. However, if you want to download more than one file, obviously it actually is faster to do in parallel multiple file downloads.
That makes sense.
So within a file, don't break up for download, but with many files, do in parallel download.
Yeah. Okay.
And the throughput he's getting is
just—it's good,
crazy, right?
He's sort of responsible about the reporting that he does too. Like this note is actually, hey, look, you may have noticed this. Here's some explanations why the data is what it is, and you know he doesn't just sort of go, hey, here's what I measured. Yeah. That's probably it. He actually thinks hard about why he's seeing different things and gives some reasoning behind it, so that you know you can sort of understand the results that he has. So this is pretty cool. I'm hoping that he continues and does some more things on this, because it's interesting and it's very end to end what he's doing. I mean, he's actually saying, look, if we really wanted to download this many files here, let's try the whole thing. Not let's try this little piece and extrapolate what we think is going to happen in the broader scale. Like he actually does it all. So you get to see the real world stuff. So that's pretty cool.
We're looking forward to part 11, Rob. So.
I'm not looking forward to part 11 because I'm going to take the under. I think it's 10.
He can go part 1 to 11 just for me.
Oh, that's true. You should do that. Rob, please do that. okay, so that's the news, which means we are on to our feature this week, which, as Ryan said, there are really kind of two main points, I guess, we should talk about. And one is how to use the local storage in your VM, how to think about it, and then how to use it properly. And two is this idea of combining roles, which really just sort of came out as I was writing the code. It just seemed like a good way to accomplish what I was doing.
Yep.
And I've actually since then just saw there are two posts on the forum right now that relate directly to this sample, sort of by accident. And one of them is because someone's trying to replicate the functionality that this does, which I'll show in a second. And the other one is because someone was asking the question about combining roles and asking, should I run hosted web core in a worker role and thus get sort of web role stuff plus worker role stuff? That's a reasonable thing to do. This is a different approach, which is using a web role as sort of both your standard, you know, IIS hosted stuff plus some worker role-ish things.
And this kind of goes a little bit hand-in-hand with what we talked about last week, which was really, again, around getting the most out of your roles.
Yeah.
So you could say, in a way, dynamic workers are also a way to combine roles.
It is true. Right there, it's more, it's combining multiple workers or, you know, different kinds of work into one.
In this, though, we're saying, you know, in the past we've said, look, you have a web role and you have a worker role, and the worker role could be doing anything, it doesn't matter what it is, But if the worker role is really not doing that much, or it makes sense, you can actually pull that into the web role.
Yep.
And that's a perfectly valid thing to do. So.
So here's what the thing does. What should we capture? Let's go to windowsazure.com. Basically, this lets you put in a URL. It goes off to the web, downloads windowsazure.com, renders it, takes a snapshot of it. Mm-hmm. And so in a second here, we should see this is an image. This is a PNG image of what windowsazure.com looks like right now. And so basically it's taking, thumbnails of web pages or whatever.
Right.
I've seen people ask a few times how to do this. So part of what I'm going to do is show you exactly what tools I used and how I put it together so you can do this yourself if that's what you're trying to do. But along the way, there's some sort of more generally useful patterns that we'll talk about. Here's the one that I like to do. I like to put in the app itself and have it take a screenshot of itself.
And I had mentioned this would have been awesome if it was like recursive.
Yeah, Ryan wants it to go infinite levels deep, but all it does is sort of the homepage of the thing.
Like a mirror within a mirror within a mirror.
Yeah, exactly.
Stuff.
So that's what it does. It's actually running at webcapture.cloudapp.net. It's not scaled for very high usage, so I don't know if you guys all try it on Friday. I might have to spin up some more instances. But you can go ahead and try it if you want to actually use it. Once it's done, you can actually go directly to the image, and that's just hosted in blob storage, and so you can just download it from there. Okay, so that's the functionality. So the question is, how did we build this? How did we get this going? So let's step through some of the code, and I'll point out some highlights. And one thing that I want to point out about how this is done is that I'm using a third-party program called CutieCapt.
It's kind of like Cutie Pie, but Cutie Capt.
It's a little bit different, but it's like that. The cutie part probably comes from the fact that this uses the toolkit QT, as in the letters, as part of the UI stuff, and then it's I think it's WebKit underneath that as the actual rendering engine. And so basically, this is an executable. You can go download, just go look for Cutie Capt. You can get a zip file that has this executable in it, and you just run it from a command line. You type Cutie Capt URL equals something, out equals filename.png, and it'll just splat out a PNG to disk. And what is unique, perhaps, or at least particularly useful about Cutie Capt, is that it works properly in Windows Azure running inside a job object. So where you can't get handles to Windows, and some it doesn't, you don't need, there's no dependence on GDI stuff to actually get the screenshot.
And so security context.
A lot of things you may try and will work fine on your local laptop won't work once you run under the dev fabric if it's sort of job object related, and may not work once you run it in the cloud, even if it worked in dev fabric, once you get to, you're not an admin, and there's really no UI context, and there's some other sort of slight differences to running on this like headless server versus running on your laptop where you're logged in interactively. Okay. So one thing that I know people have had trouble with in the past, or I seem to remember, is there's another one called IECapt, which is based on Internet Explorer, and involves actually sort of having IE do the rendering and then take the shot. And it seems like that doesn't work in the cloud, but I've sort of heard anecdotal evidence about all these things, so I'm not sure what works and what doesn't. There is a thread in the forum, so if you go look at the MSDN forum and just go search for this stuff, you can actually find a thread where right now we're kind of debating what works and what doesn't. For now, this is the one that I know works because it's up and running in the cloud right now.
We can prove it.
CutieCapt is the one that I would recommend. Yeah, we have the proof. So that's basically how this thing is working. So, I mean, all the interesting sort of, runtime stuff it has to do is just handled by CutieCapt. I mean, that's how it creates the image and things. So, let's talk about, first, how we're using local storage here, because CutieCapt doesn't understand blobs or tables or anything like that. CutieCapt understands I'm going to pass in the command line out equals and some file name, and it's going to create that file on the local machine sitting right where it is. So what I've done here is I've given it a specific path to where I want the PNG to go, and that path is in local storage that I've declared in my application. And so if we click on here.
We should mention, and I think for a lot of users who've used Windows Azure before, this is probably pretty obvious. For some folks who haven't looked at it too closely, there's might be a misunderstanding at some level, which is there's storage, there's drives on your Windows Azure instance, Yep. Like there's actual, like you would think like a disk, like hard disk, server, right? You know, yep. NTFS file system. And then that is local to that VM, so other VMs can't see it, it's not shared, it's not replicated, anything like that. And then there's the storage system, which is blob storage and table storage and things like that, where that is actually replicated, it's also visible to all your right. instances. But
and it's not on the VM, it's sort of centralized somewhere
exactly.
else. Exactly.
Right? So there's a couple ways of, if you want things that need NTFS, specific stuff, there's a couple ways of doing it. One is you use the scratch disk, as we'll call it, on the VM, the disk that's only visible on the VM, and the other is you use something like Windows Azure Drives. And we can kind of go into the details of why Steve didn't use Windows Azure Drives here as well, and there's reasons to choose one versus the other, but it's good to know that there's two types of storage here.
Right.
So don't get confused. We're not talking about blob storage. We're talking about the actual disk.
This is not a storage service. This is not. There's no network or whatever. This is the VM happens to have a disk attached to it, and we're going to use that in here. And the reason why I'm just using this is because ultimately I want to just stick this in a blob somewhere. And so the process here is going to be write it to the local disk somewhere that I have access to, right?
Right?
Immediately just copy it off to a blob and then delete it. So I'm not actually using that for any sort of, it's a temporary place to sort of spit out that file and then copy it off. Using something like Windows Azure Drive might be appropriate, where I actually wanted that to be backed by something durable so that if my VM rebooted, I'd still have all those things or whatever. Or even if I scaled, I could sort of get that drive from somewhere else or I could download it locally, things like that. Here, I just want some place to just stick the thing temporarily. Yeah. I'd be happy with sort of an in-memory drive of some sort, whatever. I just need a place to write it. Qtcap needs it to be sort of an NTFS location.
And want to offer those images as well for download.
Yep.
Using them as a Windows Azure Drive doesn't make as much sense.
Right.
Because you can't expose a file within you can't expose a file within the drive itself externally as a REST endpoint for you to hit in the API. So
if you look at like the thumbnail sample in the Windows Azure SDK, this is one of the samples that's built in there. That's where all those images get stored in blobs, and it's so then you can display them in a web page and users can just get them and whatever. And I want to do the same thing. I just have this limitation that the tool I'm using, this Qtcap, has to write to a local file at some point. And so I need a local file, but it's really just as a temporary thing. And that's, I think, one of the better uses of the local disk that's on the VM is for stuff that you need a disk, you need a file for whatever reason. Maybe it's just because it's too big to keep in memory for right now in the middle of what processing you're doing. I don't know.
Temporary buffers.
But some sort of temporary thing where you just want to write it there, and then you're either just throwing it away completely, or you're then going to move it to some durable place or do some next step with it or something. But the key is that you can't rely on that sort of living on forever.
Although we should mention, right, there's this feature that, you know, so the point here is you can't rely on the scratch disk to be around. Like we could lose the rack, and then the hard drive could go, whatever.
The drive could just fail or
absolutely. So it could be gone. However, we will, if your role just crashes, like let's say it's just a problem in your code, your role crashes, you actually have an ability to enable kind of a sticky storage. We call it clean on role recycle.
Yep.
I think.
Yep.
As an option.
And here's the checkbox here, and I actually have it checked. I think by default. In Visual Studio, it won't be checked, which means that if we just restart the role instance, the stuff on that disk will still be there.
Yeah.
I actually checked it because if something goes wrong where now if this crashed for some reason, it might be because I couldn't write the file for some reason. Maybe I forgot to delete some old thing and I have some. And so I see it as a feature if Windows Azure would just clean that up for me because, as I said, I don't need any of that stuff. It was there just temporarily. And this way I get back to sort of a known good place.
But if you were doing a process that had a lot of buffering, maybe it was a long-running job, your role crashed, but you wanted to come back and look at the work that had been buffered up, if you enable this, you would at least have a shot.
Right.
Now,
there's no guarantee.
No guarantee, but you at
least
have a chance.
But we do our best to try to leave it around there so that you could sort of recover from where you are. So if you know how to, if you can handle that, if you can handle there being some intermediate data that was there at the moment you crashed or something, right, then it's good to sort of leave it there. If you can't handle that, actually just check that box because then we'll clean it all up and you don't have to worry in your code about handling these weird intermediary states. So long-winded way to say I basically declared something called local output, which is probably a weird name for it, but basically this is my local storage thing. I said I wanted a gigabyte because I don't know why not. None of these images are ever big enough, but
1,000
megabytes. Okay, fine.
Western Digital gigabyte.
And this had the effect of, I guess, in CSDef, or is it in CSConfig?
It's in the def.
Here, I'll have to zoom this one a little bit. But here you see the same thing. This is just a local. That's all it's doing. This is just the Visual Studio UI that does the same thing here. So it just put that in there. That tells Windows Azure basically to provision some directory somewhere that I can use that is guaranteed to have 1,000 megabytes of space where it's okay for me to write things. And so that way, in my code down here, I can use this API here. Gosh, I made that line really long. This is the important part, I guess, here, is this role environment.get local resource local output dot root path. And that gives me some path to some local space. So I can't predict this name up front. It's going to be something that Windows Azure determines at runtime and basically will give me a path to that I can use. And so I've basically taken that path, put output.png on it, and that's where I'm going to write things locally. And so the step here is basically, you know, start this new process, qtcapped, point it to that output.png, start the process. Once it's done, check for the existence of the file. This was to sort of protect me from qtcapped ran successfully but didn't actually produce anything. I didn't want to get in some weird loop of of retrying this thing over and over again. So I basically check if it exists. I ignore it completely if it doesn't exist. I just pretend it worked. So this is not a very robust way to do this. I should sort of surface the error back somehow. But then I get this blob that's named sort of after the job I'm doing, and I upload that PNG to there, and then I delete the local file. Next time I would just overwrite it anyway, so it's not really a big deal that I delete it. I just delete it because I like to keep sort of the steady state is once I've done some piece of work, I'm back to where there's nothing on the local disk.
Right.
Anything I need is in blob storage. This just helped me keep straight kind of the order of operations here. So this is in the run method, which is exactly like you would see in a worker role.cs. The difference is that when you start a new project in Visual Studio and you create a worker role, if you look in worker role.cs, there's a public override void run, and it says something. There's some comment right at the top that says, here's where you do some real stuff.
Yeah, thread sleep.
Yeah, there's some thread sleep.
While true.
Print working, you know, thing. When you do this with a web role, the template doesn't actually have the run method in because it's rare in a web role for you to actually use this. Usually the web role, usually no one even opens it up. If they do, all they see is this. Yep. They see on start where they're starting a diagnostic monitor. They see this logic around handling environment changes. That's it. Maybe you've put in here sort of the logic to let you do from configuration settings. It does that niceness or whatever. But that's it. That's all that's in here to start with.
Right.
All you need to do, though, you can still do it. You just need to do public override void run, and you can implement the same thing. Windows Azure treats these things the same way. I mean, when we start up the role instance, we don't care if it's a worker role or a web role with respect to this file. I mean, we'll still launch. We'll call on start. We'll wait for you to come back from that. We'll execute run. And if you ever return from run, we'll assume that something went wrong and it crashed. And so it's exactly the same as doing a worker role. Except that, of course, in a web role, we also start IS, but it's sort of a separate thing, which means you can combine these things very easily. Just create a run method, do all this stuff, which otherwise I would have just done in a worker role. And so it's got while true, get a message. If I haven't seen the message a lot already, I've started making this kind of part of my boilerplate message handling code, is if the DQ count gets too high, I just delete
it.
Yeah, I just skip it. And then parse the thing out. There's a little nuance here to the format of the message, where I basically need a way to find that item once I've created it. So I give it a GUID, and that's how it's going to be named. And so the message itself is actually what's that GUID, and then what's the URL I want to take an image of.
Right.
So I split it out, and I get both of those things. And then we go through and run this thing. And alongside all this is the rest of my web role code. And so this is I used ASP.NET MVC. I have a controller here that does nothing interesting, and then has some AJAX methods for actually handling the UI is all sort of AJAX, and so there's a method that handles submitting the URL. There's another method that lets me check the status. So I check the status every few seconds, and when that blob actually exists, and that's what check status does, is it just checks for a blob that's named by that GUID. Mm-hmm. And once it exists, it returns the URL. Otherwise, it just returns false. This is what happens when you switch to the client side and you have JavaScript. So you start doing non-type safe stuff. So this returns either a string or false. So that's what it does. So it's just checking to see if that thing exists. And so the web rule itself is, I mean, the UI is pretty simple. It's just a form. Yeah. It sends it back. And then there's this just, am I done yet? Am I done yet? And then the other thing the web role is doing, because it's doing so little work on everything else, is I figured, why not put that worker role stuff in there first? So as I started writing the code, I thought all that stuff's going in a worker role that's monitoring a queue. Once I got going, it just seemed kind of like a waste, and so I just put it in the same role. And that's, I think the best and simplest way to take a web role and a worker role and combine them. Just copy-paste everything that you would have put in the run method in the worker role into the run method in the web role. And now these things are competing. Yeah. I mean, they're running on the same VMs, which means if QDCAP really sucks up all the memory, then somebody might load the web page and it might not load. But
I think it makes sense.
I think it really makes sense,
though, obviously, when there's some relation between the website and what the worker role is doing.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't just, if I have a worker role, then also run some random... if I had a web role, I wouldn't run some random worker role process that had nothing to do with the functioning of the web role. I would kind of want to keep those things together as a unit of update, at least.
Yeah.
So if I'm going to service one, I'm probably going to touch the other anyways. In this case, like, QDCAP is a key. Like, if it was, it has to be used, otherwise the website doesn't have anything.
Right. Pretty much every hit to the website involves then creating
QDCAP,
a piece of work here.
So,
in fact, I could have done this. One thing I think is worth noting is I could have made this synchronous. Like, I could have made it, you submit the form and QDCAP gets launched, and then we sort of go back. What I was worried about with doing it, you know, synchronously is if you really had 10 people hitting this thing at the same time, I bet, not knowing how QDCAP is implemented or anything, but I bet it's a bad idea to actually just launch QDCAP 10 times at the same time.
Right.
And they're all and then I don't have to worry about them all writing to different files because I'm doing more than one at the same time.
Yeah.
And it's actually harder. And a queue is really nice in that it just serializes all that. So everybody loads the queue. I just take them one at a time and process them as fast as I can. I also, with a queue, know that if I crash in the middle, I'll just pick it up again the next time.
Exactly.
Since
you crash, you know, your sticky storage goes away because you wanted it to.
Yeah.
And the file won't be there, and you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
You just pick up again.
It's really straightforward to have a queue here, even though you normally think of queue as a way to coordinate among different roles or something. Here, even though it's probably the same machine, there are actually several instances, so it might be going cross-machine, but it's probably the same machine just launching this thing, but it was still easiest for me to use queues to manage the work, make sure I did them all, roughly in order, that I did them at least once, that I actually got the message and completed the work. And so it's sort of handy. Once you get used to doing things with queues, I guess it becomes a really natural way to do
it. Is how you went back to your roots and pulled out some hardcore Ajax.
Yeah. That's people don't know, but I used to be the Ajax guy back in back before, basically right before I joined
before Windows Azure.
I was working on ASP.NET Ajax, which is now totally different and uses jQuery and whatever. So none of my skills translate at all. But yeah, I did go back to my Ajaxy roots.
All right.
So I think that about covers it. I'm gonna try to put all this code on my blog probably before this show actually gets out. If not, probably over the weekend or something. So so you guys will get to go download it and check it all out if you have any questions about it. But you've basically seen all the code by now. I mean, it's not a terribly complicated thing.
All right.
And so you can check that out.
Well, with that, we have our tip of the week this week.
Yep.
And, I think we're going to do something based on the theme, which is multiple instances. So we're probably going to need some sort of multiple instance themed tip of the week. I'd say
if we had
double the Steves, you know, we'd have...
Can we have evil twins?
Yeah, evil twin Steve. I think we'll have to pose for that later.
Okay.
But...
Let's have something like that. That makes sense. So there you go. Replicas of some. Okay.
We need to. If you have more than one Steve, you can load balance.
So it's like Cloud Cover or Clone Wars.
Right. And we still want to point out that this week in Channel 9, still enemies of the show.
Yep.
So
specifically Brian Keller.
Brian Keller.
Let's be clear.
Okay.
It's Brian.
With that, here's your tip of the week.
There you go. Okay, so the tip of the week is something that surely we have mentioned at least once on the show before, but keeps coming up and is something that is worth mentioning again and actually just being really explicit about, which is if you want your app, in some sense this makes total sense, right? If you want your application to be up all the time, given that every once in a while a specific instance might die because of a hardware problem, or you might be rolling out an upgrade, or we might be rolling out an upgrade that involves having to reboot the VM. That may go down every once in a while. So if you want an app that's up all the time, despite the fact that any individual instance is not guaranteed to be up all the time, and in fact will most likely be down sometimes, the only solution is to have multiple instances. And so it sort of makes sense, but the only way to make sure that you always have at least one instance running is to make sure that you have more than one instance to begin with. And so
Minimum is two.
That's more than one synonymous with minimum two.
But that's to meet the SLA. Like, you don't have to have 10 to meet the SLA.
And that's
you need two.
That's the SLA is a really good point, which is we can't guarantee we like to make very good guarantees about high availability, and we do. We make some good guarantees about that, but only if you have more than one instance. Because if you have one instance, there's nothing we can do. We know that you're going to be down occasionally. If you have more than one instance, then we're very careful.
Per role.
Yeah. Yeah. So
you have to be qualified, right? So if you had a web role and a worker role, I have two instances.
Yeah. One instance of each.
That doesn't work.
Doesn't cut it.
It's two per role.
Right.
To be clear.
So it's two per role you care about. Like, I actually, my blog is running two instances of the web role because I want it to be up all the time, and it's running one instance of a worker role because I don't care if the worker role just sends tweets every time I post something. So it used to do spam checking on comments also, but I disabled comments. So all it does is send out a tweet if there's a new post. I don't care if for 5 minutes that's offline because it's in the middle of a reboot. That doesn't matter to me, so I've only put one. But I do that knowing that that means I don't have an SLA around uptime of my worker role. I do have an SLA around the uptime of my web role because the web role has two instances.
Only two? I would have figured you'd have at least 200.
Yeah, for the traffic
World's most scalable web blog.
Yeah.
Do we call them web blogs or just blogs?
I think web blog makes you sound really old. So, you want to have two instances. Yeah. What's working against you on that? Visual Studio. It's not really Visual Studio. It's the templates in Visual Studio, which by default...
Jim Nakashima, folks.
Jim Nakashima, who you may remember as the guy on the show who didn't know
anything about Visual Studio.
The Visual Studio trivia. It's just embarrassing. He works on the Visual Studio tools. The Visual Studio templates all say here instance count 1. This is probably too small for anybody to see. I don't know. But it says instance count 1. Here it says 2 because I've changed it. But by default, it always says instance count 1. So when you do file, new project, cloud, whatever, you're getting one instance of every role.
And before
that's
you
actually
deploy,
fine when you when you F5 deploy. And whatever, you know, when you're running locally, it's actually kind of nice. It's less processes. My laptop's old. The fewer things that are running, the better. And so that's actually, I mean, it's okay for when you're testing. When you go to deploy, nothing's going to warn you or stop you and say you should really deploy two instances of this. So it's up to you to, before you do that, go in here, change it to 2. If you, like Ryan and we've discussed this before, Ryan and I both frequently deploy something and then go, oh shoot, as soon as we see the 1 on the portal that says it's deploying one
shoot
instance.
Shoot is exactly what I say. Oh,
that's modulo the vowels.
Ah, shuckies.
I say shoot. And then you can just on the portal go to configure change the instance count there. So you can also do it on the portal after you've deployed. But keep in mind that you've just done that. When you go back to your machine, it still says 1. So if you go deploy again,
redeploy, it writes it over.
You're going to say, shucks.
Darn it.
And have to do it again. So
dag nabbit, Steve.
My advice is the first thing you should do,
Email Jim Nakashima,
but until he does something about that. I'm not even sure. It's just the templates. Like, I don't know if he actually owns that stuff. Anyway, but email Jim anyway. Tell him we told you to. Change the instance count to 2 right off the bat, just so you don't forget. Even if you deploy and realize it then, make sure you do it in Visual Studio. And so that's the tip, is make sure you're doing that. If you're not doing that because, well, hey, you really just want to run one instance, you don't want to pay for two instances, whatever, great, do not contact customer support and say, what gives, I just went to my website and it was down for a few minutes. If you have one instance, I guarantee you're going to get a form letter back because I've looked at that form letter that we've sent out. And that's really one of the reasons we bring it up here is that not everyone really gets that that's actually, it's not just a, oh, something went horribly wrong and a hard drive crashed. It's a fairly, it's more regular than you would think that we're rolling out new bits to the cloud, like a patch comes along and we want to patch that underlying OS.
Every month we're going to patch where appropriate, so at least once a month.
And even if we're not, even if you've set us to not patch your VM, we're going to have to patch the OS that's behind that, which means we're going to have to reboot, which means we're going to restart your VM. So even if you're not actually getting patches, if you're not rolling out any changes, we'll still do it. And so you got to keep in mind that that's going to happen more frequently than you might think if you're thinking of, well, how often do I have to reboot my server in my data center? Maybe it's not that often.
Well, you're probably doing it every month. Probably don't even notice it.
Yeah.
Because your IT pro is doing it, right?
Yeah. So the key is, it's going to have, you are going to have downtime if you have only one instance. If that's okay, I mean, then okay, it's, I mean, right? But then our SLA does not apply about availability. We're not going to have much sympathy when one of your users hits the website and it's down. And so it's really better if you sort of get that message that, that you need to have two instances.
So put into. I just want to point out one other thing. Guess who the Visual Studio evangelist is?
Oh, you know what?
Everybody should contact the enemy of the show, Brian Keller.
That is a good point.
You know what you did.
Forget Jim Nakashima. Email Brian Keller. Now he knows exactly what he did.
This is clearly Brian Keller's fault.
He's related to Visual Studio, which is the tool that happens to have this in it.
Yep.
And so, therefore, it's Brian Keller's
fault. And if you have any feedback for the show, as always, get us on the Twitters and fax machines. Still valid.
1-800-CLOUD-COVER.
We will take letters. If anybody actually sends us a letter or a fax machine that we can print, mail us a fax machine. That we can print. Please, keep it clean. We've had a few that were a little risque.
But we'll bring
Samantha
them up on the
show. J. Billinger in particular.
Don't send anything to 1-800-CLOUD-COVER. I shouldn't have said that because that's bound to be somebody's phone number.
Yeah.
So don't do it.
Yeah.
Please.
With that, we're going to wrap up and we will see you next time.
Bye.
Thanks.